antiferromagnetic interaction. So the Hamiltonian was J S I dot S G. And we are looking at antiferromagnetism, so, or locally antiferromagnetic interactions, so J is greater than zero. And the question we asked was, what is the ground state? And we showed that for the ferromagnetic case, it was very easy to find this maximally high spin state, which was indeed the ground state, and we looked at excitations about that. Now we have changed the sign of J, and the question is, what does ground state look like? So a very interesting calculation you can do with just two sites. Suppose I look at two sites, and I look at, so to say, the nail state on two sides. This I'm calling the nail state, the up-down state for two sides. And if I look at, apply this Hamiltonian on these two sides, you can easily show that the energy will turn out to be minus J over 4. Okay, I'm talking about spin half operator. On the other hand, if you take this state, the singlet state, which I define to be up, down, minus, down, up, the energy of this state turns out to be minus 3/8 G. Actually, can we have the screen up, please? Nobody's hearing me today. Usually in outer space, somebody hears me and it goes up. But okay, what you want to see is that when I have a singlet, which is this up, down, minus, down, up state, if I again apply the Hamiltonian on that state, it has an energy which is minus 3/8, which is minus 0.375 G. So it's already lower than the nail state energy. And that gives a very good clue that the ground state must be consisting of these kinds of singlet bonds. And today in the tutorial, you will do some really interesting examples of three-site and four-site systems with antiferromagnetic interactions and find the ground state. The idea for the singlet state was proposed in 1973 by Phil Anderson. Mean in that. So if I look at four sites, an idea of that, and I construct the possible singlet configurations. One other important point to say about the Hamiltonian is I'm considering bipartite lattices. Which are these AB, AB, where I can separate it into two parts, an A sublattice and a B sublattice, such that all the neighbors of A are on the B sublattice and vice versa. So if I take four sites, I will get these two states, psi 1. So this is a singlet on sites 1, 2, 3, 4. So this is a singlet on 1, 4, and 2, 3. And I would also get another possible singlet, which is this one. Okay. And what you will see in today's afternoon class is that the Hamiltonian in this basis of psi 1 and psi 2 will have some diagonal terms, but also some off-diagonal terms. This will not be non-zero. And because of those off-diagonal terms, you can lower the energy even further than minus 3/8. And that's the resonance. The fact that the system is a linear combination of this and this, it's resonating between these two states, lowers the energy even more than minus 3/8. Okay, so keep this in mind, and in the afternoon when you're playing with it, you will see this in action. So finally, what you find is for the 1D quantum antiferromagnet, the energy will turn out to be minus 0.42 J per particle, per site. So that's how much it will lower the energy because of this resonance. So the ground state then ends up looking like, and this is really obtained from the knowledge of the beta ansatz, the ground state then of an antiferromagnet consists of singlets, not just nearest neighbor if you have many sites, but these are singlets of various lengths, various bond lengths. So let me just say, draw it here. And it's a linear combination. It's a linear combination of all configurations of singlets between A and B sublattices. If I take some set of sites, I could have singlets like this, that's a bond. That's one configuration, and you can have many such configurations, and the ground state is really a soup. It's a linear combination of all of these configurations, and that's what a quantum antiferromagnet looks like. Now, even with these singlets, the system can or may not break the rotational symmetry of a nail state, and that is discussed by checking the log, the correlation functions. So if I look at S0, SR, and I correct for the fact that I have a staggered order with this minus 1 to the power r, then in 1D this decays as 1 over r to the alpha. This is in 1D. So that implies no staggered long-range order. On the other hand, in 2D, this correlation function goes to a constant at large distances. This is the staggered magnetic moment square. And this magnetic moment is equal to 0.33 as opposed to 0.5 in the layer C. So now you understand why this moment is reduced, because the nail state has these quantum fluctuations built into it, and the nature of those quantum fluctuations is really the singlet character of the ground state. Okay, any questions? Okay, so now one can ask, in this bipartite lattice, of course I got a singlet in only 1D. What happens in higher dimensions? Can we get such kind of liquid states? So these states where it does not order are called spin liquid states. So let's go to higher dimensions. And okay, so the requirements that you need for a spin liquid are, first of all, it must be a Mott insulator, which we haven't really discussed, but just think of it as an insulator with one electron per unit cell. So when we were discussing the interacting Fermi gas or the non-interacting Fermi gas, we labeled the state with the momentum, k. And we filled each k point with two electrons. If we had a spin half, then up and down electrons go into the same state k. At that point, the system is completely filled, and then we would have typically called that an insulator. Now, in this case, the Coulomb interaction is going to play an important role. So even when you have just one electron, the second electron costs an energy to be put there. And so the system already becomes insulating even with one electron in the unit cell or in that particular K point. So that's what we mean by a Mott insulator. And that's what you had here. You had these sites, and I had n sites and n electrons. So that's like one electron per unit cell. And the second thing is that it must have, there should be an absence of antiferromagnetic long range order. So that means does not break rotational symmetry. Now, how could we get such states in higher dimensions? You have any ideas? What would we need to relax about the conditions we created to get such a spin liquid state with no order in higher dimensions?
J being greater than zero, you could have J different at different sites, for example.
Right. Your J could have like competing antiferromagnetic and ferromagnetic interactions. That's one way. Another way is to put the system on lattices which are not bipartite. So like, for example, the triangular lattice. So if I have a triangular, so this is called, possible ideas are, so we could get frustrated. You know, frustration, as the name suggests, you're being pulled in two directions, right? And that's what generates frustration. Otherwise, life would be cool. We would just be following, you know, the path of least action. But now there are two competing interactions telling us to do two different things. So for example, if I have a triangular lattice, and let's say I'm looking at an Ising model, even simpler, with j greater than 0, then my spins want to align antiferromagnetically. So this bond is happy. I have an antiferromagnetic alignment. But this one is not sure. Should it satisfy that neighbor, or should it satisfy the other neighbor? And so this spin here is frustrating. And you can, of course, if it's a Heisenberg model, and I take three sites, then again, classically, you would say, OK, this is pointing, the spins are achieving their minimum, the configuration that gives you the minimum energy is this 120-degree rotated spin configuration. But now, again, if you put many of these together, you start to see that the ground state will generate certain chiral currents in this. And that's another thing you will see today when you do the three-site Heisenberg problem. So these are the kinds of lattices one can look at. And only very recently have people been able to obtain the ground state of the antiferromagnet on a triangular lattice. That's a very recent result. And what they have found is that so let me define the Hamiltonian as some J2.
Was this an analytic result? Was this an analytic result?
No, actually not an analytical result. It was practically there are no analytical results once you go beyond 1D. So this was obtained by series expansion. So what you do is you sort of start with your, you make the XY coupling J and the Z coupling different. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you write down the Hamiltonian as, let's say, JZ, SIZ, SJZ, plus some JXY. And let's say you expand in JXY over JZ. That is your expansion parameter. And you go to high order in this expansion. And of course, finally, you're going to set lambda going to 1. Right? So that's why it is tricky. But this series expansion was carried out. And what was found that for the triangular lattice, there is ultimately, you can look for the fluctuations around this classical state, right? You can ask for the fluctuations around that, and you find that there is still long-range ordering with a moment which is around 0.1. So the moment is much less than what it was on the square lattice, but nevertheless, it survives. So we didn't quite get there. So the next idea was to see if one could add some more terms in these spin interaction terms. And so this is now taking me a little further away, but I'll just indicate to you where we are on this story. Okay. So here is the triangular lattice, and you can write the Hamiltonian, this antiferromagnetic Hamiltonian, in terms of sort of permutation operators, which are on a bond. So P12. So P12 is nothing but S1 dot S2. Minus 1 or something. Okay. And then you can put a additional terms, which would have this sort of a ring exchange term around a plaquette. So, you know, higher order terms. And we don't need to get into too much detail here, but basically all I want to say is that you can expand the Hamiltonian to include more fluctuations of a particular pattern along which these spins can exchange. And these processes essentially are trying to kill that ordered state by putting in different types of fluctuations. And these, if you derive these spin Hamiltonians from more microscopic interactions, they don't just give you nearest neighbor interactions. They will give you next neighbor and so on and so forth. And in those higher order terms, there are additional additional interactions, longer range ones. And if I look at the ordering as a function of J4 over J2, then you find that this is the triangular lattice, Heisenberg. And somewhere around here, the system goes from an ordered moment, which may be small, but here it goes into a spin liquid where the moment is indeed zero. Okay, so you are sort of seeing something like this. This was already a small moment of around 0.1. It finally gets destroyed there, and then the system goes into a spin liquid. So these are the kinds of things you can do, but now I'm kind of really getting into what is current day research. And the most amazing thing is that these are not just hypothetical models that you write down. There are actually materials which show this, these particular structures and these properties. Okay, any questions? So I'm going to show you some experimental data very soon, but part of the reason for the excitement here are the nature of the low energy excitations. Why are spin liquids so hot? It's a very hot topic today. And the reason for that is that you might think of some ground state which looks like this, all these singlets, and here is, let's say, a broken singlet pair, one component of the broken singlet pair. There's an up electron there. There's a down electron there. And these are called, so these things here are called spinons. And these are S equal to half excitations. So they are very much like particles, as opposed to S equal to 1 excitations that we discussed earlier, that were the magmas. Okay, so these spins, essentially one can show that they are not non-interacting. What we found in the case of magnons, and that's what helped us make a lot of progress, is that these magnons were then the eigenmodes, and they were practically not interacting. These spinons, on the other hand, are strongly interacting with, gauge sheets. Okay, U1. Etc. Okay, so to do a theory for this is then a sort of the challenge of many body interacting systems. And that's kind of where I would have to leave it and just say that these grumps, these thin liquid, ground states, can have or not can have this, have topological order. So they have a different kind of order, very different from the spin-spin correlation order that we talked about. It's a different kind of order. I won't go into that, but I want you to get a view of where this field is headed. The ground states have multiple degeneracies, which are connected by some topology. And that's what distinguishes the different ground states. And in this particular deconfined phase, it does not pick any of those topologically distinct states. It's a fluctuating between all of them. So that's kind of the picture of where, from a simple antiferromagnet, the field takes us into all these very exciting systems in higher dimensions, where because of frustration, the system is unable to order. And it generates these new kinds of defects which are strongly interacting by gauge fields. So before we get carried away, let me actually show you some experimental systems where this is indeed found. So can I have the screen again?
A question. Can you find it somewhere in the natural world?
Yeah, that's what I want to show you. That in the natural world, you can find it. So let's look at some. But you have to look for it. And you have to know what to look for, as an alchemist. Does anybody remember how I get my screen to communicate?
I think it's
going to be around 10
seconds.
Sorry?
It says 2
minutes. Oh, it says 2 minutes. Okay. And there's that mirroring thing. Okay. Okay, this is just a very quick historical note showing Louis Neel, who first identified antiferromagnetic ordering. He got the Nobel Prize for that. This is Cliff Hsu, who used neutron scattering to see antiferromagnetic ordering. So this is very interesting because a neutron carries a magnetic moment, right? So we talked about looking at structure using X-rays. Now here, we don't just want the structure, we want the structure of the local moments. And so if I take the neutron, it has a magnetic moment, and that moment has an interaction with the ordered moments of the system, manganese or nickel or what have you. And so it is able to pick up the plus minus ordering of those moments. Okay. So now here, so as I said, a possibility is this triangular lattice. Another even more frustrated lattice is the so-called Kagome lattice. So this is something that occurs in nature, you know, like this basket. Of course, the basket is not quantum mechanical, but we'll come to that. But that's what the structure looks like. It has these hexagons with intervening triangles and so on. Now, if you put spins on such a lattice, they have amazing properties. And we don't have to go and put it. They actually are found in nature in some complicated mineral. Okay, so that's kind of the beauty of this field. You go, you're a mineralogist, and you find some Herbert Smithite, some complicated structure, but then if you look at it more closely, it is literally these hexagons with triangles, somewhat bent and so on. But you know, as we know, many of these distortions are irrelevant, right? They may be irrelevant perturbations. So it's on these systems that now, how do you look for antiferromagnetism? What is the signature? The signature is that, so as you know, if I want to know if some material is a ferromagnet, how would I look for that? You would measure something called the susceptibility, spin susceptibility, right? So let's just remind ourselves of that. Okay. So spin susceptibility. Chi, which is delta m by delta h, as h tends to 0. And m is the magnetization. And chi, and h is the magnetic field. Okay, so just to get started, we know that if I have a paramagnet with some magnetic moment, the spin susceptibility goes like 1 over the temperature, right? This is something you would have seen in like a classic statistical mechanics class. You have just a paramagnet, and it has a magnetic moment. And if I apply a magnetic field, then its susceptibility is proportional to the inverse temperature. And it looks like this. So it never orders. So here is chi as a function of t. Now, if I have a ferromagnet, then what happens is the susceptibility is initially like a paramagnet, but if there is a phase transition, then you know that near a phase transition, the fluctuations become very large, and the susceptibility is a measure of those spin fluctuations, and it diverges at the transition. So this is chi versus t. And in an antiferromagnet, what you have is, and I'm not really deriving that, but you can show this, that in an antiferromagnet, the susceptibility goes like this, and then it has a gust, and then it decreases. And this temperature is called the nail temperature. The crucial thing is that for a paramagnet, you have no interaction between the moments. For a ferro and an antiferro, you need an interaction J. And these temperature scales are on the order of J typically. So T nail is also on the order of J. Okay? Now, what you find in a spin liquid is that the temperature, so you can independently measure J. How do you do that? You can look at the high temperature behavior, and basically from that you can get an idea of the bare interaction J.
Shouldn't it be negative for an antiferromagnet?
Susceptibility?
Yep.
No, susceptibility is always positive. The reason is, from here you can also say that M goes like minus the free energy del F by del H. Okay? That's the magnetization, and so chi is going to be so chi is going to be the second derivative. So basically what you're doing is you're sitting at a minimum, right? And the susceptibility is telling this is a minimum of, let's say, the free energy versus H versus the magnetic field. This is the minimum at some value of the magnetization, and you're trying to look at the curvature. Okay, so chi is like the second derivative. Maybe that's a plus. So then you have del 2f by del h squared. So it's the curvature of that minimum. That tells you how susceptible it is. If it's a very sharp minimum, the system is not at all susceptible to any fluctuations. If it's a very shallow minimum, that's what happens near a transition, then the susceptibility becomes very large, but always positive. That comes just from the stability of the system. The system would not have been at that minimum value if the curvature was not positive. It would have transformed into a new system. Okay? So the crucial point I was getting at is that these transition temperatures are of order the interaction between the spins. But what you find in these frustrated lattices is that the ordering, you keep looking for ordering at the scale of J, which is in this case 170 Kelvin, but what they find is down to millikelvin temperatures, orders of magnitude less than the bare scale, there is no ordering. And that is a direct consequence of there being these quantum fluctuations, which is pushing the ordering down. So now the question is, what about zero temperature in the ground state? And that, of course, becomes an academic question. It's already interesting that down to six orders of magnitude smaller than the bare scale, no ordering has been found. So this is a very good candidate for such spin liquid. This is only one indicator. Now you can look at other things like specific heat, and you know, if the specific heat was coming from magnons, then you know the specific heat should have gone like T cubed. But on the other hand, if there are these spin-ons, and spin-ons are like Fermi particles, S equal to half, then we know that for fermions, you know, the specific heat goes like temperature, linear in temperature. And there are very strong indications that in these materials, the specific heat is in fact linear in temperature. So that's another corroboratory evidence that something strange is happening in the ground state. Okay, so that's one material. Here is another material. Again, we, you know, mostly they are pretty complicated, but you know, for our purposes, the when you distill out of it the lattice, it looks like those simple models that we have been talking about. So this is a big charm of condensed matter. It connects with real materials. You elicit out of that some simple Hamiltonian, and then you can do, you know, very nice quantum mechanics with that. So these materials are basically triangular lattices. Let me show you what they look like. So, you know, this is what they look like. You know, if you look at the formula, it's even worse, very complicated. But bottom line, these are hexagonal lattices. And on these hexagonal lattices, you have this ring exchange. And again, the crucial thing is J is something like 3 or 250 Kelvin. And on these systems, you don't see ordering down to 35 millikelvin. Very good candidates for spin liquids. Okay, I'm not showing you this, but you know, we will slowly get into situations where spin liquids and other interesting phases come together. Of course, we won't look at all the details, but what you, I'm trying to give you an idea about is that they really do exist. And now, even in three dimensions, there are these materials called iridates, and they sit on what is called a pyrochlore lattice. This is a tetrahedron where the corners are shared. This is a corner-sharing tetrahedral lattice, again, highly frustrated, and there are strong indications that this is a spin liquid.
So a question. If it's called a spin liquid, can you have it in some macroscopic size? As in, could you have a sample big enough so that it would still show this behavior? Or you could
These are all macroscopic.
So how does it look like? Well, I'd say.
Oh, in terms of what it looks like, you wouldn't be able to tell. For example, you mean in terms of its visual properties?
Mm-hmm.
You know. So
if I were to touch it, how would it behave?
It would behave like a solid. So it's really a solid as far as the structure is concerned. Mm-hmm. It's the spins that are being disordered. So the spins are a liquid. The crystalline structure is still a solid. So you know, high temperature superconductors, which have these really fantastic systems, it just looks like a black pellet you would have picked up on the street. But it's when you look at its properties, they are pretty amazing. Okay, so that's kind of what concludes this part. And okay, can I have this up? Can I have the screen up, please?
My intention was I was asking this question because I mean, you don't, when you touch this table, for example, you don't press into it because of Coulomb interactions.
Yeah.
If the spins are really behaving like wet liquid, my intuition would be that I could press into it like into a liquid.
These spins are still actually you can actually show this very formally. I can take the antiferromagnetic Hamiltonian and you can map it onto either a fermionic or a bosonic system. And even the bosonic system is a hardcore bosonic system. So finally the statistics still shows up in preventing double occupancy. You can't lose the fact that you had fermions.
Okay.
Yeah. Pauli principle is still being obeyed.
But
yes.
The RSK liquids have or temperature available because the spinous excitations only appear at a temperature, a very low temperature, right?
The excitations?
The spinous.
Yes.
So
yes.
Do we have spin liquids? Have we observed spin liquids at room temperature?
So in a way, what you're seeing is that, say at zero temperature, these materials I showed you have some spin liquid ground states. The behavior at finite temperatures is still some kind of a collective state described by these sort of critical theories. So it's not like ordinary paramagnets, even at finite temperatures. And there will be a range of temperatures which will continue to show these novel excitations. And then beyond that, it will become like a free particle.
But that's still in the millikelvin.
Pardon?
That's still in the millikelvin range rather than.
No, it can. So I will come back to this when we talk more about quantum phase transitions. So, quantum phase transitions technically happen at zero temperature. The ground state goes from one kind to another kind at some critical tuning parameter. The effect of that quantum critical point can be felt all the way to very high temperatures. It can be felt on scales of order J. So it can be felt on room temperature scales. The fluctuations are still controlled by that low temperature fixed point. Okay, so what I want to do next is to, I was going to map this antiferromagnet to a bosonic system, but maybe I'll come back to that later. Instead, what I will start now is, I'm just trying to think what is the best route. Maybe I should do that, because that is an interesting direction, interesting connection with that. I'm going to show you an exact mapping of the quantum antiferromagnet to bosons. And I'm going to do it in a simple situation of S equal to half, but it can be done more generally. And this is also called the Matsubara sometimes the Schwinger boson. Comes under various names. But the basic idea is really simple. For S equal to half, what I'm going to do is to go from spin operators to boson creation creation and annihilation operators. And just using the properties of the algebra of spin half, I can define Si plus to be a boson creation operator, Si minus to be a boson destruction operator, and since Siz is Si plus Si minus minus half, that goes to Bi dagger Di minus half, which is Ni minus half, the number operator. So here, Ni is Bi dagger Di. Okay? And we also have, because these are spin half operators, we have the following property that Si plus minus anti-commute. On the same site. And that implies that Bi dagger square is equal to zero. That means these are hard core bosons. Transformed into J over 2
be better described by Feynman's theorem.
You can have a similar fermionic description as well. I will come to the reason for describing them as bosons in just a bit.
Because the Bi dagger is squared going to zero. This looks exactly right.
Yeah. So I should say that on different sites they commute. Okay. So that's another thing you should write down. But on the same site they behave like fermions. But on different sites, they commute, so they are like bosons. Okay, so that's what this object is. It has both bosonic and fermionic commutation relations. Okay. So in other words, a Bi, if I look at these B operators on different sites, they would basically obey commutation relations of bosons. But I will come to why the bosonic picture is useful in just a bit. So I have this term here, Ni and J, plus a constant coming from the En minus half term. And this constant is nothing but the nail state energy. Okay. Now, I'm going to do, so if you look at this term, what it sort of is showing is that this one is describing the kinetic energy of bosons on sites, right? This takes a boson from site J, destroys it, creates it on site I. So this is a boson hopping operator. This is a term which says if there are bosons on nearest neighbor sites, it costs some energy J. Now there's one thing about the sign of this hopping operator. It is positive. Usually we have a negative sign for hopping because whenever a particle hops, it reduces its energy. So I want to discuss that and show you a very basic property of the antiferromagnet which allows us to rotate the spins on the on one of the sublattices. So you can do basically a unitary transformation on B sublattice. the z-axis. And this unitary transformation only on the v-sublattice changes si plus to minus si plus. It rotates the spins, si minus to minus si minus, and siz, which is the product, then goes to itself, goes, remains unchanged. Okay, so if you make this sublattice rotation, what you get is it basically, these are always connecting A and B sublattices. This sign here, so then apply sublattice rotation. And that basically gives you a minus J over 2. Plus the other terms. Okay, so another way to understand this minus sign is to go into momentum space and write these bi's in terms of bk. Okay, I'm sure you have done that in various contexts, so let me just give you the answer. Suppose I write bi to be bk. Let me do it the other way around. Bk is 1 over root n. Sum over I, e to the I k dot r I b I. Okay, and I put this in here, and I notice that I and j are just nearest neighbor sites. Then what you get is, what's the following? This thing will then become equal to sum over k, epsilon k, bk dagger, bk, okay, plus the other terms, which I can leave either in the I basis or the k basis, it doesn't matter. Let's say the other terms. Now this epsilon k has a cosine dispersion. So epsilon k is basically minus 2j cos k mu a summed over mu going from 1 to 2. So it's essentially a cosine dispersion. So this is epsilon of k as a function of k. Okay, so what this minus sign has allowed you to do is previously the ground state was sitting at k equal to pi, right? That is the nail state, up, down, which had an oscillation of pi. And by doing this rotation, you've brought the minimum to k equal to 0. And that's kind of what we would like to see for the particle problem, because it's in the k equal to 0 mode that we would like to see Bose condensations. So you've just shifted your spectrum from pi to 0, and that is what has been achieved by the sublattice rotation. Okay, but now this brings up a very nice way to visualize the ground state of the antiferromagnet. For example, the nail state in this bosonic language is written as particle empty, so that's the nail state. okay? And you can see what will happen when I add this Hamiltonian on this state, right? Clearly, the interaction term is zero for this, because there is no nearest neighbor. Two bosons are not sitting on nearest neighbor sites. But the hopping is going to hop a boson from one site to another, and that's the same process that was interchanging the up and down spins on the different sublattices. So the quantum fluctuations are going to be things, are going to mix in configurations like something like this. Etc. Right? And so they are coming about because of the kinetic energy. System is trying to gain more kinetic energy by mixing in these configurations. And it's that which is ending up lowering the ground state energy. So this is another language you can see things in. And the point about this is, you know, different methods, different representations lend itself to different approximations. So now we have a bosonic problem, and we can apply some tools for bosons to address the ground state of this bosonic Hamiltonian. And so what I'm going to do next now is to come to a general bosonic Hamiltonian and look at that system. It doesn't even have to be a lattice. Any questions? Yeah.
I didn't really see how you visualize the bosons here. What can you hear? The dots and crosses.
Okay. So what I have done is I have, wherever I have an upspin, okay, so okay, let me explain that. Okay, so I can take vacuum. I can take vacuum and apply B dagger on it, right? And what this will do is create a boson. So if I do it on the IS site, then let me say my vacuum is nothing on any of the sites. I apply BI dagger, and what that does is on the IS site, I will generate a boson, which I'm representing by a dot. And in a similar way, so this dot you can also think of in the spin language as putting an upspin there. And then I can go on and write, and the downspin, I just think of it as an empty state. So the two states of the spin have become the two states of the particle in terms of occupied and unoccupied.
So the others are excess.
Pardon?
All the other entries in this are just crosses.
Yes, that's right. So it depends how you set up the problem. Okay, for the spin half, the bosonic Hamiltonian can become even more general. So in the what I'm going to look at, if I'm studying antiferromagnets, I want to look at SD total equal to zero. I want to look at S total also equal to zero, but I want SD total to also be zero. That means number of up must be equal to number of down, right? And in terms of particles, that basically means that I want, if I have N sites, I must have N over two bosons. So that's the sector in which I'm looking at this. But in general, I could look at any density sector and generalize the Hamiltonian even further. Okay? It's what is called half filling. Okay, so now we can just look at boson Hamiltonians in general, and I will then later on come back to these lattice Hamiltonians.
It's a kind of type of bosons that can't go into bulks and a condensate.
I'm sorry?
It's like a type of bosons that can't go into a condensate.
Okay, that's a good question. So basically the analog, okay, so the analog of long range order of staggered moment, NS, this is in the spin system, and in the particle bosonic system, this will be the condensate. Okay, so the exact statement that you have that these spins can organize themselves in a long range ordered state, that statement is exactly equivalent to the bosonic problem having a condensate, meaning the lowest eigenstate is maximally occupied. So the fact that in 1D, the condensate was destroyed by quantum fluctuations is also analogous to, in the bosonic problem, the system now not having a condensate. So that delta function peak has been suppressed all the way to zero because of quantum fluctuations. Okay, so we want to calculate that. So let's take a general Hamiltonian for bosons and see what we can say about that. These are precisely the questions that become interesting. Question?
No, that this picture is in position, but I mean, in energy, the bosons can be in the same energy of the boson, right? I mean, there is nothing that just for we've seen how is the wave function will make it impossible. I mean, seeing that the dispersion relation, all the bosons can be in the zero, right?
Say that again. I'm sorry.
Seeing the dispersion relation there.
The special relation.
The dispersion relation.
Oh, dispersion relation.
Yeah, we could think that we will be able to have a condensate, but same thing condensate. So why don't we have?
Okay, so the point about this is, you see, if I had only the kinetic energy term, okay, so this is a very hard problem. It looks deceptive, but let's look at this Hamiltonian. This Hamiltonian has kinetic energy of bosons, interaction between bosons of two kinds. One is a hard core, and the other is the nearest neighbor. Okay, forget even the nearest neighbor one. Just the hard core is enough to say what I want to say here, and that is, if I had only this term, just the kinetic energy, it has this dispersion. And then you're absolutely right, if they were bosons, they would all condense in the k equal to zero state. The question is, these bosons are strongly interacting with the hard core, and that hard core is going to deplete that condensate. And that's precisely what we want to calculate. What is the depletion of the condensate by hardcore interactions? Now, hardcore is very difficult, so we'll first start with a weakly interacting Bose gas. Okay, so that's our approach, is let's look at a weakly interacting But of course, our sights are much higher. We will go to hardcore, and we will try to see how the condensate is destroyed, and new kinds of spin liquids and all that emerge. But this itself, you will see, is quite a difficult calculation. Not difficult, it's doable in 15 minutes, I think. Okay, so I will follow the in Fetter and Walechka. And also you can look at Huang. So this was done by Bogoliubo very many years ago, 1947, even before I was born. Okay, so the main thing we will see from here is there are two very important things that come out of this calculation. So first, let me write out the Hamiltonian. It has some non-interacting part plus an interaction, and that is of the form sum over k, epsilon k, ak dagger, or rather, I use a's here, I use b's there. Let me stick with a, because I'm going to transform them and then I will be using the b's. So ak dagger ak, epsilon k 0 is h bar square k square over 2m. And the interaction part is, this is the volume, is of this kind. I have two bosons that come in with momentum k and p. K and p, and they interact. This internal momentum is q, and then they go off scattered with k minus q and p plus q. Okay, and this interaction I can write as some potential dq a dagger p plus q a dagger k minus q a k a p. Right? It's a density-density interaction, and I have normal ordered it. And so I have this four bosonic operator interaction. Right? This, have you seen these kinds of terms before? I'm sure from your field theory course you have been looking at these kinds of interactions. Okay. So now what we are going to be able to do is only solve it in the analytically only solve it when the interactions are weak. So weak interactions basically implies that n minus n0 over n is much, much less than 1, where n0 is the number in the condensate. In the condensate at k equals 0. Okay, and the other thing to say is that n0 is of order n. It's macroscopic. Try to destroy a particle in the condensate at k, in k equal to 0 state, so this is my ground state, and I try to destroy a particle, I will get n0 bosonic enhancement, but because this system is macroscopic, there's no difference between n0 and n0 plus 1, that means I can essentially treat these A0 and A0 dagger as just C numbers, as just not as operators but as numbers. And I'm going to treat a zero expectation value as just and zero. Okay. So with that then, this four Fermi, not Fermi, the four boson term, I can basically, by giving the condensate a C number, I can start to collect the terms and put different processes together. So let's write down all the possible processes I could have. This is something where I'm in the condensate and I remain in the condensate. Okay, so this is a scattering process of two bosons that come together and they remain in the condensate. Then I will have other terms where, let's say, I have two coming in. Two coming in with momentum k and minus k going back into the condensate and exchanging some momentum k here. Okay. Another process could be, so this is, it can be the inverse one, where I have two bosons coming from the condensate and they go out as in k and minus k. So this is minus k, that is k, and here I have some momentum. Okay, add that, and then I can have things where one boson is in the condensate and one is in a k state. So I can have something like this. One is in the condensate, here the dotted line. So I'm showing by dotted all the condensate processes, and by k, the boson which has a momentum outside the condensate. And then the opposite exchange process, which I can draw like this, and then that goes up here, that's zero, k, k. And then you can have a process where it's the same boson, zero exchange here, zero, zero. And then the reverse process, which is like this. K, K, zero, zero, zero. Okay, I think these are all the processes you can write at the lowest order. And from here, let's just, given that four boson interaction, let's write this down. This will have a V0 because there's no momentum in the going through that line. And I will have N0 square. Right? Because each of the A's gives me a square root N0. This process will give me VK, N0, and then AK, A minus K, right? Because two bosons are being destroyed with K and minus K, that picks up from the from the condensates, and Vk is the internal momentum. Okay, so now you can write it down for all of them. This one, for example, will have a Vk N0 Ak dagger A minus K dagger, two daggers. Here there will be an Ak and an Ak dagger. So this is a Vk N0 Ak dagger Ak. And this one similarly, you know, are the same kinds of terms, all of them. We will have a Vk N0 Ak dagger Ak. Okay, so these are the kinds of terms we get. Okay, so now we are ready to collect all of them. And okay. So now the interaction term, you can collect all these terms and you get 1 over 2 omega from prefactor V0 N0 square, and please check all my terms here. Sum over K prime, this means K equal to 0 not included. Vk plus V0 plus N0 sum over K prime Vk and an AK minus K. Okay, so this is basically quadratic in the boson operator. So it's essentially telling you it's almost a free field theory, except there is a little complication in that these terms are not conserving particle number. So if I was writing them in this A basis, you have sort of the diagonal terms which are coming from the kinetic energy and from this term. They are of the form AK dagger AK. They conserve the total number. But this term is not conserving total number because it creates two particles or destroys two particles. So the way to handle that is you can always think of putting a chemical potential to work in the grand canonical ensemble. And the main thing one wants to do is a transformation. You want to sort of rotate your basis so that the Hamiltonian becomes diagonal in this rotated basis. And you get rid of these off-diagonal terms. This is a very beautiful construction that we will see again when we are doing superconductivity. And the meaning of this rotation is something we will discuss in quite some detail. Okay, but for now, our aim is to go to a new basis and rotate these A's. So, let me just rewrite it a little bit by just collecting terms in some way. So if my total H now, I'm going to bring in my kinetic energy term as well and put that together. And then I have half
question. How did you get the volume going to numerator?
I put n, which is n over omega. Now let's do the transformation. Going to do what is called the Bogolio ball. Transformation. And the main point here is to write a new set of operators, introduce boson operators. Operators by a unitary transformation, by a canonical transformation of this kind. AK UK VK these are different from the big VK. These are coefficients and UK. And I'll tell you what the meaning of this is in just a bit. Okay, and we want this to be a canonical transformation. Which means that basically BK, BK dagger, this commutator is also obeying the same relations. And then the ones where it's BB, then those are zero, and B dagger is also zero. Okay, I'm not writing that. Maybe I should. Okay. So if I do the inverse transform, then I get BK, BK dagger, B minus K dagger is UK, VK, VK, UK times AK. And when you write down the inverse matrix, you will see that you will get a determinant. When you take the inverse, there will be a determinant of this. UK square minus VK square, and for this to be a canonical transformation, it requires that you choose UK square minus VK square to be equal to 1. Okay, for all K. But UK over VK is still arbitrary. Okay, so essentially what you have done, let's try to understand the meaning of this. Let me write out, let's say, one of them. So for example, let's write down A minus K dagger. Just that one. So that is So that is UK B minus K dagger. Minus VK, DK. Okay, so what is this telling us? This is basically saying that if I want to create an excitation with minus K momentum, right, I can do it two ways. Either I create this new boson with minus K momentum, or I destroy a boson with plus K momentum. That also adds effectively minus K, by destroying a momentum of plus K. So both these operators have the effect of reducing the momentum by K. Either I create a boson with that momentum, or I destroy a boson with opposite momentum. So what you are starting to see is that the ground state is going to mix in particles and holes. Okay, that's the structure of the ground state. You started with bosons, but because they are interacting, they are going to mix in particles and holes. And this is something we should think about today much more. It will play a paramount importance even in superconductivity. So let me just say that both operators here decrease the momentum by V. Okay, and it's essentially particle sort of hole mixing. That's what this canonical transformation is doing. But the advantage of this is now we can go to town. We have everything in place. We have the Hamiltonian with that term which has A dagger, we have the transformation, we can put it together and demand that the new transformed Hamiltonian not have any off-diagonal terms of the kind B dagger, okay, because that was the whole point of doing this transformation. We don't want these B dagger terms. And that will give us a condition, and from that we can then get an idea about the ground state and the excitation. So let me write one step and then we'll pick it up tomorrow. So basically the upshot of this will be that when you substitute the Bogoliubov transformation in H and what that will yield and demand that the off-diagonal terms be zero, and that what that will give us is a Hamiltonian which is then essentially a constant plus, let me call that zero, plus something which is EK, EK dagger, EK. Okay, so it will look just like a ground state with excitations on top of that. This does not involve the k equal to zero mode. So what we would have achieved from here is a diagonalization of the problem in this new basis. And we would have a ground state, which I will write down more explicitly next time. And we have excitations on top of that with an energy EK. And EK will have a very interesting structure. It will be essentially K, and I will derive this more carefully next time, but I want to just end with the punchline. Why we work so hard is the following. So it will have this. And what we will be able to show is that for as k tends to 0, ek will go like some constant times k. So this implies that we have gotten sound modes or a linear mode where the bare dispersion epsilon k was going like k squared. Okay. So the upshot of this is that the non-interacting bosons had a parabolic dispersion. They were like free particles. You start making them interact, even if the interactions are weak, it mixes particles and holes through that canonical transformation, and the result of that is the formation of these long wavelength modes, very much like the sound modes with a linear dispersion. So I'll stop here now. Next time what I'm going to do is do a little more of the algebra to fill in these blanks and then discuss a little bit exactly what is that long wavelength fluctuation. We know that in the case of the crystal, it was the positions of the particles that were fluctuating, that were moving from point to point, and that's what generated this long wave. What is the analog of that in the case of the superfluid? What is that object that is fluctuating from point to point that is generating this wave? Okay, so we'll discuss that next time. Thank you.